Let's go.
The CMU podcast in association with 7Digital.
This week, SoundCloud, transparency and Spinal Tap. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. We've been off for 2 weeks. So
3 weeks, really.
3 weeks.
So two editions missing.
A lot of catching up to do. Anyway, I'm Andy Malt. He's Chris Cook.
Looking back in the last 3 weeks,
forgot
of music.
That I'm supposed to do that bit.
Well, you sort of got the slogan wrong, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, you forget these things over.
Because we're looking back at everything that has happened since we last spoke on this podcast. That said,
all of these things happened in the last week.
Well, that's because we can't really remember what happened 2 weeks ago. We weren't keeping a very good record of what was happening in the weeks we weren't here. But
I'll tell you what I really enjoyed.
These stories have all been evolving over the 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it is the last 3 weeks in music.
I think I most enjoyed
During
our break, those special edition podcasts from the Output.
They were good, weren't they? Did you enjoy them?
They were really, really interesting. Who would have thought that that person would say that thing?
Which one did you enjoy the most?
The digital one.
The digital
one? Oh, no, the PR one. No, they were both very good.
They were both very, very good. Yeah. Andy Malt here is alluding to the fact that on the last edition of the CMU podcast, I said that I was going to the Output conference in Belfast shortly after that recording. I can't quite remember when. The last few weeks have been a bit of a blur. And that I was going to record the interviews because we were presenting two sessions at Output this year, CMU Insights. We presented a session on music media and PR, a session on streaming and digital. And I said we were going to record the interviews and share them with you with two special editions that would come out in the slots when we weren't here because we were off being busy elsewhere, mainly in Ireland, various different parts of Ireland.
And Wales.
Northern and Republic of. That didn't happen. Sorry about that. But I did record the interviews.
That's step one.
So I did do that bit. I even bought a new device. You mentioned that I'm currently going to Wales every Wednesday, which I am, for the CMU DIY program that we're doing as part of the Barod program organised by the Soon Festival. It's really good. I'm really enjoying it. I think the 15 artists who are participating, well, they keep coming. So that suggests that they're enjoying it. And they asked some very good questions of a guy from PRS yesterday. So that was a very good session yesterday. But then 3 weeks ago, I can't remember when, there was 1 week when I was going to Output the next day. And I knew we needed three recording devices in order to capture the interview.
Yeah,
I didn't have the third device. Mm. So I rushed from when I was going from the office to Paddington Station. I took a shortcut via Argos on Tottenham Court Road in order to buy another recording device because we're very high-tech.
Yeah.
CMU. So I went to all of that effort so I could capture these interviews. And then the Tottenham Court Road Argos, this isn't really on topic.
It's not. It sounds like a lot of excuses.
A very quick aside, the Tottenham Court Road Argos is one of those that's trying to be sort of, a bit modern.
That's how they all are now, aren't they?
But it's whitewashed brick walls.
Well, yeah, they're all done out like an old street bar.
And they're not all like that. The one in Leytonstone's not like that.
All right.
The one on Tottenham Court Road is really trying to be an Urban Outfitters, but it's an Argos. To the extent now that rather than giving you a number to tell you when your product's ready to pick up,
they give you a cocktail in a jam jar.
They give you a pager that buzzes when your thing's ready, except that there's nowhere really to go. So everyone is standing by the counter watching stuff come. Anyway, I got the other device, so I recorded the interviews. They're great interviews, but I've had a very busy fortnight. I haven't had a chance to sort of mash them together. But there is still going to be a special edition of the podcast, which basically I'll put them all into one podcast. Doesn't seem any point doing two podcasts now. So I'll put them all into one, and so you'll be able to get a CMU Insights podcast from Output in Belfast. So it'll be online soon. It's been saying soon in the daily.
It has.
For 2 weeks now.
I've been chuckling to myself every day.
Yeah. Well,
especially when you updated it in the second week. So they'll both be online soon. Oh, yeah.
Well, it amuses me that you've been reading that bit at the top of the daily every day and laughing, but you didn't notice. I don't know why I'm admitting this on the podcast. That for the entire week after the original event, the blurb said, yesterday. CMU Insights presented. So you were too busy chuckling to actually correct the error. Anyway, that's all a bit of a shambles, but it's going to be a great podcast. It's going to go live at some point and you should listen. And if you like it...
Maybe we'll go live next time we have a break.
If you like it, you should tell us, because if you do like it, the next of these events... So CMU Insights at Canadian Music Week is happening again.
Mm-hmm.
all about digital dollar and transparency, which we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
But we'll be doing that in Toronto in April. CMU Insights at Spot. That's a new one.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
You've been to Spot.
I have. It's good.
I've never been to Spot, but we're doing CMU Insights at the Spot Festival. That's very early May. It's YouTube, friend or foe, is what I've called it. So it'll basically be a bang up-to-date update on all the Safe Harbour stuff in Europe, and then we'll slag off YouTube for 40 minutes.
Cool.
Or perhaps we won't. Yeah. Perhaps we'll have a love-in with YouTube. So that's CMU Insights at Spot. And then, of course, 2 weeks after that is CMU Insights at The Great Escape. Some announcements about that coming up next week. Going to be brilliant. And so if you like the addition from Output...
announcement. it's going to be brilliant. Nothing else.
Yeah, that's it. 28 times in bullet points. So I can't tell you about the updates yet, but on next week's podcast I will, because the announcement will have happened by that point. There's also some festival announcements coming up next week. Loads of Great Escape. In fact, the next week's podcast, that's all we'll talk about. We'll talk about all the Great Escape bookings and the conference stuff.
Well, something to look forward to.
My point is, if you like the Output podcast when it eventually comes out and you tell me, then I'll record my interviews at these other events that CMU Insights is presenting in the coming months, and I'll share them with other special little editions of the podcast as we flow. That's my point.
Okay.
I also went to Dublin last week.
Yep.
That's only of note because I flew into Dublin in the midst of Storm Doris.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sort of embarrassed that I'm embracing this thing of... We've decided we're going to give. When it was a bit windy now, we have to give it a name. I don't think I approve of that.
Well, it's been windy without it having a name. It was quite... It was like it was extra windy.
But I know, but it sort of makes... I don't know why in my head it makes sense to give hurricanes names, but not just quite strong winds. But anyway, we've all embraced it. So let's roll with it. Storm Doris. And I flew into Storm Doris as we were landing in Dublin because I was doing another CMU Insights event for the guys at IMRO. And, well, that was quite entertaining, landing a plane in Storm Doris. I mean, I wasn't landing the plane.
Yeah, I landed on a plane in a storm once. It wasn't that much fun.
He managed to land second go. First go. Oh. And it probably wasn't actually like that. It really felt like we were almost on the ground before he decided to have a second go and took off again. But I was sort of looking out the window as we were flying in, and we probably weren't as close as it felt, but it felt like we were very close to the ground. And I remember looking out of the window and sort of thinking, well, if that over there is the runway, this plane isn't going in the right direction. And then almost immediately he took off again. But on second go, he landed. So there was a happy ending to that. I was able to land. And that was the day of my little Brits report. So I was able to land and write up my Brits report. Had that plane crashed into the Irish Sea, you wouldn't have had my Brits report.
Well, that would have been a great loss to all of us.
So I think we all benefited from that Ryanair pilot's... everyone clapped. People talk about that on social media.
Well, clapping on planes.
It's never happened to me before. I very rarely leave Shoreditch, so I don't really fly very often. But I've never seen people clapping on planes before. But they did that time.
And I think in a situation like that, it's okay.
I think it's
just a normal day.
It's sort of. I suppose presumably everyone's got pent up stress that they want to get out, and clapping is a way of getting out. But it's sort of like, well, what are we? Are we? I mean, what are we clapping? Sort of, well done, pilot, for not crashing the plane. I mean, if you can't land a plane when it's a bit windy, you shouldn't be a pilot. So I'm not sure he earned his round of applause, but he got one. Anyway, that's been my few weeks. The conclusion is that podcast is coming. Special edition. CMU Insights at Output.
Well, let's stop looking back.
Well, that's the whole point of this podcast.
Well, it is the whole point. I realised that as I said it.
We can't look forward.
Let's stop looking back at other stuff and forward to podcasts that haven't happened. Let's just get on with this podcast that's here right now. Is that succinct enough?
I have to say that I think my failure to get out this special edition of podcast pales into insignificance compared to just how bad that segue was. But anyway, let's carry on. I'm going to drink some water while you remind
people. We haven't got time to retake it anyway. So
what we're talking
go.
About this week.
This week, we'll be discussing new moves to get the British government to bring in laws forcing transparency on digital music royalties.
Catchy.
And the response to Spinal Tap's $400 million lawsuit against Vivendi. But first, let's talk about SoundCloud and its mid-price streaming service that it has just launched this week.
So remind me, Andy Malt, because you have been paying attention to these things. Is it since the last podcast that FT report about SoundCloud came out, or was it just before the last podcast?
I believe that happened since the last podcast. Yeah, the FT ran a story saying that SoundCloud... Well, there was a report a little while ago. It came from a SoundCloud financial report that they might run out of money by the end of this year. And then the FT published a story saying that SoundCloud was going out trying to get new finance, and it was basically begging for money and no one would give it any.
So that was the Financial Times quoting an unnamed, anonymous German, no less, financier. It was basically calling SoundCloud's latest funding round, passing the begging bowl around the financial community. SoundCloud were not impressed.
They were not happy about that at all.
They expect more of the Financial Times. They didn't actually say fake news, but that was, you know, that was almost a cliche term they were trying to latch onto. But what we do know is this is a make or break year for SoundCloud.
Yeah.
It really is. This one is going to be the make or break year. As you say, we do know that they need to raise more money because they've been going a very long time now. Their costs have gone up because they've done these licensing deals with the record companies and the music publishers to shut up the music industry. And, well, that, I don't know how much money that's costing, but it'll be costing some money. So they desperately need to start bringing revenues in. And obviously, last year, once they'd done these licensing deals with the music industry, they launched these new products. So whereas traditionally SoundCloud made its money by charging the content creators to upload their content, so they were basically selling hosting and streaming services.
Which they still do.
But they also launched SoundCloud Go, which is basically their Spotify competitor. Plus, they are putting advertising around the free platform,
yes,
and so they're selling advertising. So they've developed these new revenue streams to try and grow the business, to persuade people that they have a long-term future so they can find these new investors to give them that new money to keep the business going so they don't run out of money at some point this year. I've not actually met anybody who signed up to SoundCloud Go yet.
No, well, it's now Go Plus as well. Because as if it wasn't already confusing. If you go to the SoundCloud website and just go, right, I'm going to find out how much a subscription streaming thing costs, quite hard, because they push the pro accounts, which are different. Those are the ones where they provide hosting and space for creators to upload music. And you have to hunt around a bit for the Go stuff. I mean, obviously, if you come across music that's only on SoundCloud Go, then that pushes it to you. But in terms of like their premium offerings, it's quite confused.
And the development this week is, so SoundCloud Go now is about a year old. So it was basically £10 a month. And in return for that £10 a month, you get everything that's on SoundCloud anyway.
Yep.
Without the advertising.
Without adverts.
Not that there is that much advertising, yeah, but there is. Plus, you would get access to a whole load of content from major labels and the big indies who had been doing a good job of keeping their tracks off SoundCloud. It's now up there, but only if you pay £10 a month and
yeah, so you basically, you get the 120 million tracks that are already on SoundCloud, plus yeah, another,
including the CMU podcast,
another 30 million on-demand, like your Spotify sort of on-demand music.
Yeah, so basically the music that was on Spotify but wasn't on SoundCloud.
And that was called SoundCloud Go, but now that's called SoundCloud Go Plus because SoundCloud Go is now a mid-priced offering that doesn't offer the on-demand streaming service bit but offers everything else. So no ads and access to music that's already there.
Yeah, so let's go back through that because that's a bit...
I told you it was confusing.
So the development this week is that as of now, there are, like with Amazon, there are various different options on SoundCloud. Let's ignore SoundCloud Pro. Let's forget that doesn't exist because that's just an extra bit of confusion we don't need. So from a consumer's position, there is SoundCloud Free, as there always was.
Uh-huh.
There is SoundCloud £10 a month, which was added a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
But there is now SoundCloud mid-price.
Yes.
So explain to us the difference between the three different options that are now available. The free version, the mid-price, which is what they're now calling SoundCloud Go, and the £10, which is what they're now calling SoundCloud Go Plus.
Well, basically, yeah, so you got your free, that's your free. It's got some advertising on it.
Thanks for that.
You got SoundCloud Go, that's your mid-price. That's basically your free, but with no adverts and a little bit of extra functionality. And you got your SoundCloud Go Plus, and that's everything plus an on-demand streaming service.
So I suppose to explain the differences, so SoundCloud Free is what SoundCloud always was, except, of course, they are now running adverts around the content, which they didn't used to. So therefore, for the mid-price, which is what? How much is it?
£5.99 in the UK.
£4.99
in the US.
Which is already, I mean, I know the pound has plummeted, but the pound is still
Brexit.
But the pound is still more than a dollar. So we're already paying more every time they equate a pound to a dollar.
Bloody Brexit.
So I don't know why we're paying five.
They haven't put up the... I think that's the weird thing. We can get onto the psychological aspects.
Hold the psychological aspects. So for £5.99 a month, what you get is basically the classic SoundCloud experience without the ads, which they added. Plus, they did add last year a bit of... It's mobile functionality mainly, isn't it? That wasn't there previously and is there if you pay the £6. So basically, you're not getting any more content. You're not getting that stuff that the majors and the big indies added a year ago that wasn't previously on SoundCloud, the Spotify-style content. You're not getting that for your $5.99, what you're getting is no ads and the extra functionality. Whereas if you want that extra content, so you want SoundCloud plus Spotify library all within one platform, you still have to pay £10 a month. I've got that right, didn't I?
Yeah.
It's interesting because, as we've talked about before, everybody agrees, I think.
Yes.
I've not checked with everybody.
Everybody agrees.
Every single person agrees that what the streaming music market needs is more variation of products.
Yeah.
Okay, there are basically currently 2.5 products in streaming. There's either free streaming with ads where nobody makes much money, or there's £10 streaming, which is basically the main product, or there are those 46 people who've signed up to Tidal, super high quality, and apparently Spotify are planning a launch in a super high quality. That's another story for another day. But there's not enough product variation because there are lots of consumers out there who might be persuaded to pay some money so we can turn them from being free users where we don't really make much money from advertising into paid-for users where we'll make more money, but they'll never pay £10 a month, £120 a year, because while that might be a phenomenally good deal for access to 30, 40 million tracks on demand, most people don't want that. And so most people agree, because some people have changed their minds since we started this conversation, most people agree that what we need is a bigger variation. So we need a free service, a £2 service, a £5 service, an £8 service, a £12 service, and so on and so forth. What people can't quite agree is, what does that mid-price service look like? Because it's got to be better than free, but what we don't want is for it to be so good that all the £10 subscribers go, ha, I'm going to downgrade and pay less money. And so obviously Amazon last year launched their version where their on-demand service, you get a little discount if you're also a Prime customer already on Amazon, mm-hmm. and you get a bigger discount if you're willing to only listen to the music on the Echo device. So yeah. they basically, it's the same content, but less functionality.
Yeah.
Whereas actually what SoundCloud are doing with their mid-price package is it's the same content as the free version, but more functionality.
Yes.
So it will be interesting to see whether or not there are any people out there who will pay $5.99 a month, not to get any more content, because perhaps they're already a Spotify subscriber and they don't need any more content, but just to lose the ads, of which there aren't many, and to get that little bit of extra functionality. And your point was that you think it has a better chance of working in the US on $4.99 than it does in the UK on $5.99, even though in theory that's only like a pound's difference.
Yeah, but just the psychology of that pricing, like $5.99 seems a lot closer to $9.99 than $4.99 does. I don't know whether the idea is, you know, a lot of SoundCloud users are already going to be Spotify users or Apple Music users or whatever. And so maybe you could convince those people to hand over a little bit of extra money. But obviously, they're not going to pay to have access to another streaming service that's like Spotify. So you don't give them that. You give them the extra functionality and no ads.
Yeah, because there probably is an audience of people who are Spotify subscribers and possibly paying subscribers of Spotify, but who still use SoundCloud for, you know, the really new stuff, and maybe the community aspect, maybe the podcasts. So they are currently using both Spotify that they're paying for, SoundCloud that they're not paying for. Therefore, offering them 30 million more tracks isn't an upsell because they're already getting that over on Spotify. But offering more functionality is potentially attractive. But what you're saying is it's not $5.99 attractive.
No, I mean, maybe a couple of quids.
Well, I think, and you're laughing at that, that's ridiculous. But I actually think you're probably right. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the various people who've played with sort of mid-price, because remember O2 Tracks that was around for a while and still lives on, actually, as MTV Tracks. The same company powers both of those services. O2 Tracks no longer exist. But their idea was that they would offer a very small catalogue of music for people to stream. So with O2 Tracks, it was like that week's top 40 and then another sort of playlist of 40 tracks around some theme. The idea being that the average person actually listens to Heart or Capital or Magic radio stations, which generally have a daytime playlist with no more than about 70 tracks on it at any one time. So that's actually what the mainstream consumer wants. So let's sell them that product at a much cheaper price point. And on one level, I think there's something logic behind all of that. I don't think that's a ridiculous idea. Core music fans, that's not attractive. But for more mainstream consumers, for a Heart listener, perhaps that is attractive. But it was a pound a week. And it was like, a pound a week for 80 tracks. Yeah, that if it was a pound a month and it was 200 tracks, then maybe actually, that's a product that will get you X million consumers who are never going to sign up to anything else. So I think that might be the problem with some of these ideas at mid-price services, is they have potential, but not at the price points. They've got to go down to about £1 or £2 a month. And obviously, I would assume, even if the companies behind these services could make it work almost at some point in the future on that price point, I suspect there'll be pushback from the music industry, yeah, who are terrified about losing the £10 a month subscribers at Spotify and Apple Music, who are obviously driving the growth of the record industry.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that part of the focus is on getting those people who are, they're a Spotify user, but maybe you can get them to spend a bit more money on getting some extra functionality on SoundCloud and getting rid of the ads. The ads are pretty annoying. But actually, if you look at the page on SoundCloud's website, it almost seems like it's designed to upsell the $9.99 option and not sell the midpoint one at all. Once you get to the $9.99, it's a big thing on it saying, best value.
So almost...
Here's some broccoli.
It feels like that they've manufactured this £6 service to not look very good, so that by comparison, the £9 service looks really
good.
Yeah,
it's kind of hard to know exactly what their intention is with it. I can tell you what they've said their intention is.
Yeah, go on, tell us what the official
Alexander
line is.
Leung said, by expanding our offering, we not only enhance the experience for listeners on the platform, but also unlock new revenue opportunities to further expand our creator payout program. That's what he said, anyway.
Well, now we know.
Yeah.
So SoundCloud Go now has different levels to choose from. So if you're a SoundCloud Go subscriber, let us know, because we're really keen to meet someone. We get you in as a guest. We'll interview you. So drop us a line and
That's it. Yeah. CMU podcast at unlimitedmedia.co.uk if you are a subscriber to any paid SoundCloud tier. Because
not pro.
Not the pro, but the Go and
we
Go.
We know
Plus.
Some pro
We'd
subscribers.
We'd really like to meet someone.
As I've possibly said before, this is the make or break year for SoundCloud. Let's see if they make it or break it.
Still to come, we got our news in brief and Vivendi's stern rebuttal to that $400 million lawsuit from the members of Spinal Tap. But now, let's return to something I believe we talked about on the last CMU podcast, which is transparency and attempts to get the government to legislate upon it.
Yes, so obviously the artist community and the songwriter community and the artist management community have become increasingly vocal in recent years about the need for more transparency around the digital music market. So to try and get more information on the specifics of the deals that have been done between the record companies and distributors and the publishers and the collecting societies and the streaming services, because obviously artists and songwriters are all beneficiaries of those deals when their music gets streamed, money flows from a Spotify to a record company to a publisher to a collecting society and ultimately flows to artists and songwriters. But there's lots of unanswered questions about exactly how those deals work, exactly what is being paid, by whom, how Spotify works out, what it owes Universal, how Universal works out, what it owes, I don't know, Justin Bieber, and what is happening to the money as it flows through the system. And this has been a debate at music industry conferences for quite a few years now. We all need more transparency. And what we've seen in the last couple of years is that the record companies and the music publishers and the societies, having initially conceded that there was need for more transparency, there was need for more clarity, have in the main started to say, oh, but we're being more transparent. But when you talk to artists and songwriters, or particularly the managers of artists and songwriters, who are the people who are trying to process all of this information on behalf of the songwriters and the artists, they're saying, yes, you're sending us a lot more data. The royalty statements you are sending us are getting longer and longer because you keep giving us more and more stats about how often our music is being streamed. But actually, it's still really hard to work out how you've calculated the royalties, and there are various questions that remain. It should be noted at this point that some labels and some distributors and some publishers and some collecting societies are way better at this than others. So it's not that everybody is equally rubbish, but there is still this need for more transparency. We've talked about it 3 times on the podcast in the last year. So first of all, when we brought out part 2 of the Dissecting the Digital Dollar report that we at CMU Insights produced for the Music Managers Forum, where we surveyed lots and lots and lots of managers about their issues with the digital market, transparency kept coming out as the top issue for all the managers we spoke to. And so we talked about that when part 2 of the Digital Dollar report came out. The second time we talked about it was when the European Copyright Directive came out, the draft new European copyright law that's currently working its way through the system, which has an article in there that is trying to help artists and songwriters get a little more transparency around their digital income. And the last time we spoke about it was when the Liberal Democrat Lord Tim Clement Jones raised the issue as the Digital Economy Bill was being debated in the Lords, proposing that perhaps they could put something in the Digital Economy Bill similar to the article that's in the draft European Copyright Directive to get a transparency right for artists and songwriters singer-songwriters into UK law ahead of Europe, given that we don't actually know whether or not we'll still be in the European Union when the copyright directive becomes law. So that's been the conversations recently. It's been newsworthy this week for two reasons. First of all, behind the scenes, while all of this has been going on, while we've been banging on about this story here on the podcast, behind the scenes, there have been negotiations between the various trade bodies in the UK that represent different parts of the music industry, which come together through the trade body of trade bodies.
UK Music.
Through UK Music. So there have been negotiations around the UK Music table where, you know, the record companies and the publishers and the collecting societies and the artists and the songwriters, the managers, all their trade bodies sit there. And there have been negotiations to try and agree a voluntary code of conduct. So it would be a loose agreement between record companies, publishers and collecting societies and artists and songwriters and record producers and their managers on things like clarity and transparency around digital. Obviously, the indies already have their Fair Deals Declaration that was put together by the World Independent Network, and here in the UK, the Association of Independent Music. So that creates a little bit of a framework. So ultimately, the aim was to try and get the major labels and major publishers to sign up to something a little bit similar. And so these negotiations have been ongoing. Actually, when it came to the majors, the negotiations were happening directly with the majors rather than via their trade body. And so the Music Managers Forum, BASCF on the songwriters, FAC and MU for artists and musicians, MPG for music producers, they've all been involved in this. And unfortunately, an agreement hasn't been reached.
They reached a stalemate.
They reached a stalemate. So Andy Edwards, who sits on the board of the Music Managers Forum, and I mean, over the years, he has worked on both sides of the equation. Yep. He's worked both at record companies and as an artist manager. He was leading on all of this. And so he wrote a blog post early this week where he explained the negotiations that went on. He was saying that, you know, lots of people participated. There was some, you know, fruitful discussions, but ultimately an agreement couldn't be reached. And so then the next step of this is, okay, as far as the artists, songwriters and their managers are concerned, this is still a big issue. They've tried to get a voluntary agreement. That hasn't come through. So the question is, well, what next? And so what happened this week is the various bodies that represent music creatives, for want of a better term, have basically turned to government and said, well, perhaps you could get involved here and perhaps you could instigate some conversations. And there is a parallel, because another development that's happened recently is that Google and Bing, which is still a thing apparently. Microsoft search engine, they signed up to a thing.
Yeah, voluntary agreement to delist piracy sites in their searches.
Obviously, as far as the music industry is concerned, and this is where record companies, music publishers, artists, songwriters all talk as one, one of their bugbears for years now is that the Googles and other search engines of this world don't do enough to both downgrade and delist piracy sites. Google has done some things over the years, but the record companies consistently say it's not enough. Google have always been very resistant of doing more to remove piracy sites from their listings. But ultimately, the UK government got involved through the Intellectual Property Office. There was talk about actually putting some sort of obligation on the search engines in the aforementioned digital economy bill. And sort of on the back of that, because there was the threat of legislation, Google and Bing came to the negotiating table with the BPI for the record companies, the movie industry involved in this as well, so that the Motion Picture Association, and an agreement was reached. So it remains to be seen whether or not that agreement works, but an agreement has now been signed up to by Google and Bing. So new anti-piracy measures should come online later this year here in the UK. And so there's a parallel there of saying, OK, well, that's a good thing. Everybody in the music community welcomes that. But as far as artists and songwriters are concerned, over here, there remains this transparency issue. Perhaps the IPO could do something similar. And the reason why this is sort of newsworthy this week, aside from the fact that Andy Edwards wrote the blog about the attempts to get the voluntary code and the fact that is now officially at an end, is because earlier this week, over there in the Houses of Parliament, they had a debate in Westminster Hall on, well, basically on all things intellectual property. So it was quite a wide-ranging debate.
Yeah.
I went.
You did.
This is how I know. I'd never been to one of these debates before. I've been to select committees in Parliament before, but I've never been to one of these. Well, I suppose it's not an old-school debate because there isn't really a this House believes and one person proposing. There was an awful lot of agreement around the table. But basically, it's just 90 minutes. Intellectual property is a topic, that's a very wide topic, and any MP is welcome to come along and basically air their views, air their opinions, list what they think are the priorities, where government should or shouldn't be getting involved in intellectual property affairs. So that could be trademarks and patents, as well as copyright. And then the IP minister, we have a new IP minister here in the UK as of the start of this year.
Joe Johnson.
Yes, brother of Boris, is now in charge of intellectual property from a government perspective. So he's basically there, listens to it all, and then at the end of the debate stands up and says, all right then, good point, good point. Not going to do anything about that. Can't be bothered to do anything about that. yeah, that's a bit of a nonsense. Oh, but that, good point, go and do something about that, blah, blah, blah. But so it all happens in this 90-minute debate. It's bang on 90 minutes. It starts bang on 9:30 and it finishes, I've never been to one of these debates before, 11 o'clock. So Joe Johnson was doing his speech. And at 11 o'clock, a bell rings. And then immediately, the next debate that's happening in that room begins. So somebody stood up and started talking about Sri Lanka because the next debate was about, I don't know, something to do with the politics of Sri Lanka. It's like, well, what's that got to do with this? It's like, all right, a new debate. A whole new debate has now begun. But anyway, this debate occurred. Various issues came up. Various piracy issues came up. The search engine voluntary code was commended and welcomed, although Labour did point out that once the Digital Economy Bill has worked its way through Parliament and the threat of imminent legislation is not there for Google and Bing, the government needs to make sure that they stick by that code. So that was interesting. It's interesting when you get debates about intellectual property on a wider level than just the music industry, that you discover what the big issues are for other parts of the entertainment business.
Yeah.
Clearly for Sky, the big issue at the moment is the fact that people are buying sort of like Amazon Fire type devices, or, you know, the things you stick in the back of your telly and it turns your telly into a smart TV. And apparently those are now doing the rounds on, you can buy them off an Amazon store or off eBay, which have software preloaded that basically you plug them in and it opens up and it gives you access to Sky TV and all this sort of stuff, but illegally.
Yeah.
You know, it's pulling it in from illegal sources. And clearly for the TV industry, that's the big issue in piracy circles. It hasn't really come up much in the music industry, I have to say, although music is available via these devices that are doing the rounds. Clearly the TV industry have been lobbying hard because pretty much every single MP who spoke opened talking about that. But some of the MPs also found time to talk about music stuff and indeed, you know, supporting artists and songwriters and music creatives on these transparency issues. And various people said that this is an area of concern and that perhaps it is something that Joe Johnson, the IP minister, and the Intellectual Property Office perhaps should be looking at intervening in.
So we'll see if anything comes of that debate or if it was just a 90-minute waste of your time.
Well, it was interesting to watch.
I'm sure. Well, it's good to know that politicians are at least thinking about these things, and the music industry lobby has got those ideas into their heads.
If you're a premium subscriber to CMU, next week's CMU Trends article will be a summary of the debate and some of the issues as it currently stands. So we'll give you more information. Nigel Adams MP, the Conservative MP who chairs the APPG for Music, he spoke up about it. As did Ian Paisley. So Ian Paisley Jr., and he was very vocal on it and very resolute about the need for artists and songwriters to get more transparency and for the UK to lead the way on this in the post-Brexit age and all of that. So there is our report up there on completemusicupdate.com, but if you are a premium subscriber, we'll go into it in a little bit more detail next week in CMU Trends.
Quickly, time to run through a few more of this week's other music business stories in brief. The alleged founder of Kick-Ass Torrents, we're still calling him alleged.
I don't know why we're still calling him alleged.
Can be extradited to the US from Poland. A Polish court has ruled. Still, doesn't mean he's going to be, but that's what has been ruled.
So the US still trying to get the founder of Kick-Ass Torrents, which of course they shut down last year, extradited to the US to face charges of criminal copyright infringement. Although apparently, we learned this week, there are 3 stages to extradition in Poland. It has to go to court twice for reasons I don't quite understand. So it has to go back to court.
That's fun, isn't it?
A judge has to say a second time, yes, it can be extradited. Then the Minister of Justice, I think, gets the final say, although there would then be an appeal stage at Supreme Court. So not quite there yet. So it could as yet be that the Kick-Ass founder manages to stop his extradition. Having said that, the whole thing is moving a hell of a lot faster than Kim.com's extradition in New Zealand.
And also, he's not been released from prison.
No, didn't get bail.
Unlike Kim.com.
Not quite sure what the timescale is for the various different steps of this. It will be interesting to see whether or not the founder of Kick-Ass Torrents does end up in a US court. And if so, whether America's case against him stands up, because his lawyers in the States reckons that it won't.
Mm. Independent music retailer Sunrise Records in Canada is taking over 70 of HMV Canada's soon-to-be-closed-down stores.
So HMV Canada has gone into receivership. We talked about that earlier in the year. So 100-odd HMV stores facing closure by April at the latest, but
but Sunrise reckons it can succeed where HMV Canada has failed.
With 70 of them. Now, Sunrise Records, it's been in business a very long time.
They've already got about 10 still, yeah, haven't they?
And
they?
So yeah. Sunrise has been going since the 1970s, I think. It also downsized its network of stores in the 2000s, like everyone else, but then it got bought by its current owner a few years ago. He then put it back up to 10 stores. But even so, I mean, going from a network of 10 stores to 80 stores in the current climate for high street entertainment retail, that's quite ambitious.
Especially when you're buying stores that have failed.
So,
well, we'll see, won't we?
Well, he was talking about trying to keep the overheads down, although having said that, you know, the owners of HMV Hilco.
It sounded very similar to HMV's strategy.
So we'll see if they succeed. I mean, I hope they do. It'd be great if they do, but we'll see, I guess.
A couple of big awards stories from this week. Rihanna won Harvard's Humanitarian of the Year.
And if you're being all sort of, pop star getting Humanitarian of the Year, you know, a bit snooty about that. It is actually for some incredibly good initiatives that Rihanna has. It's both involved in and indeed instigated.
She's done a lot. Way more, like a lot more than I ever realised.
Well, no, in some ways, and in fact, it's good she got this award to make us aware.
Well, she did start her speech by saying, it's amazing to get this award for something I genuinely never wanted any credit for. So that's possibly why we didn't know, because she didn't talk about it very much. Yeah, she's done some really good stuff and she gave a good speech.
And that's online, isn't it?
You can watch it on our website.
On the website.
Tom DeLonge, formerly of Blink 182.
Yeah, from a serious, proper, justified award to something slightly more ridiculous.
This is a serious award. He's won UFO Researcher of the Year, which is an important prize.
Am I not right in saying this relates to a Land Finally story I think we ran last year? When Hillary Clinton's emails got hacked,
yeah,
it turned out that there was a bunch of emails between somebody on her... Was it the
John Podesta, her advisor.
And Tom DeLonge, because they have a common interest in UFO conspiracy theories. Yeah. And so that was a bit of a story at the time. But he's getting UFO Researcher of the Year. But the only reason we know he did this research was because Hillary Clinton's emails got hacked. So why is he being rewarded for basically having his emails hacked?
There were more emails that had been uncovered in this batch because there were obviously tens of thousands of emails that were related
to him. Not just between Tom DeLonge and...
But when we first reported on the story, it was like they were all one-sided. They were all emails from him to John Podesta. There was no indication that John Podesta had written back. But it was very much in this kind of video explaining why he was getting the award, it did really build it up as a, like, here's this conversation he had with John Podesta and here's all the other high level people who are involved, and it's like, well, the people that he said in these, there's no obvious proof that that he was doing that. And then he gave this acceptance speech
where he took it
and then he talked about how, oh, I've got this big announcement coming up in the next 60 days. I mean, it might not look big, but it is big. And you need to look between the lines to know that it's big.
So big UFO
story.
Look
out for that.
Incoming. Forget NASA discovering all these extra planets, whatever that story was. I wasn't really paying attention. I should have been. But hey, actual UFOs incoming.
But you can go and read all of those stories in full at completemusicupdate.com/podcast, where you'll find the show notes for this show and the links to all of them. And finally, this week, we're back to Spinal Tap and a story we have discussed on the podcast before, but it's got so much bigger since we last discussed it. There was a lawsuit launched by Harry Shearer where he was saying that Vivendi, which owns Universal Music, which controls This Is Spinal Tap soundtrack, and Studio Canal, which has the film, had been doing some creative accounting over the last 20 years to diddle the Spinal Tap guys out of money, lots of money.
Yeah.
$400 million worth of money.
Well, that's the damages they're going for. I think there's some punitive damages in there too, but...
Well, a bit of interest probably gone in. But he reckons, you know, they've done him out of quite a bit of money.
Yeah, so Harry Shearer, who I suppose these days is probably better known for his work on The Simpsons, but obviously to Spinal Tap fans, one of the three main characters in that movie. And so the three actors and the sort of the creator and narrator.
Yes.
So the four people behind the movie. So when the movie was done, so as is often the way, when the film originally came out, it wasn't Studio Canal, it wasn't Vivendi, it was some other company in America, then got bought. But the original deal was that the four guys behind the movie and the music on the movie would have a profit share. And they were through their company, they were meant to see, I think it was 40% of the profits. And so what Harry Shearer's litigation filed last year was basically saying was, well, there was various elements to it, but A, we never saw our 40%. B, we've never had proper reporting. We don't know what's going on. There's all this dodgy stuff going on behind. And actually, I didn't even notice it at the time. Down the bottom of the lawsuit was the good old reversion right.
Yeah.
Which would reference our conversation about Duran Duran and Paul McCartney. Mm. Okay, 35 years nearly up, we'll have the copyrights in the music elements back. So that was all filed last year. We talked about it on the podcast. And then last month, and actually, I think this story broke just before we recorded the last podcast, but I don't think we mentioned it.
No.
So the development last month was that originally it was just Harry Shearer suing, but the other three co-creators of This Is Spinal Tap, the movie, and the Spinal Tap band, and all of the music, they basically joined the litigation.
Yeah.
So it's now all four of them and their company are suing, which is how we got up, because I think the original lawsuit was about 80 million damages, and that's how we're now up to 400 million damages, which is a massive sum of money, which Vivendi, as you say, so they own the movie through their studio, they own the soundtrack through their record company, and they believe that the 400 million claim is absurd.
Yes.
The story this week is that Vivendi have filed their response in the courts.
So from the off with this lawsuit, Harry Shearer and latterly the other co-creators of This Is Spinal Tap, as an example of how they'd been diddled out of money, claimed that in the last two decades they'd received $81 from the soundtrack and $98 from merch sales. And that was clearly not right, and they'd been done out of lots of money.
Yeah, and I suppose that the point being that although This Is Spinal Tap, when it originally came out, was a sort of a slow burner in the cinema, it then subsequently became a cult classic, very big in the home video market. I think that's how a lot of people discovered This Is Spinal Tap first time, was buying
I nearly video. Accidentally bought a second copy of it recently because I didn't realise I already owned it.
And, of course, there was all the spin-off merch and the music. So the argument being that, OK, it was a slow burner at the cinema, but actually a relatively big business is built around the movie and all the spin-offs, and that they feel that they've just never seen the share of the revenue that they were due or the reporting that they were due.
But they had those figures, and those are things, and you can't look at those and not think, you know, that seems like quite a low amount. But then Vivendi's response, they've never done an audit. And you would think before you launch a lawsuit like this, you really should do an audit. In fact, I think they're saying that it's a legal obligation that you should do an audit before you launch a lawsuit like this. And they did not do that or ever even ask for one.
Yes. So Vivendi's response kicks off by saying, when you do a revenue share deal, a royalty deal, a profit share deal with a movie studio or with a record company, you usually have audit rights in the contract, which means you can send your accountants in to audit everything. And so what they're basically saying is, well, you should have exercised your audit right first before you pursued this litigation. There's quite a lot of confusing stuff going on in the background here, conflicting stuff on either side. But certainly that was Vivendi's opening gambit, which is you didn't do the audit, so you can't sue, because they're basically trying to get the whole thing thrown out.
Yeah, and they're basically saying the reason you didn't do an audit is because you know that you've been paid properly and an audit would show that.
They don't actually respond to the ridiculously low...
I'm paraphrasing a bit there.
But what is it, the $98? As you say, I mean, those are insanely small sums of money. They don't actually respond to those allegations in the lawsuit. What they do is they do it the other way around. They say this $400 million in damages that you're pursuing, they're basically saying there's no way your movie ever made anywhere near that, let alone your 40% being worth it.
Yes, they say they acknowledge that garnered affection in the United States, but has generated US theatrical revenue of under $5 million.
Mind you, that in itself, because that's the cinema revenue.
That is the cinema revenue, so that isn't really what they're arguing.
Given that the starting point was saying, okay, it was a slow burner in the cinema, but it was the video market and the merch. So they're sort of, both sides are sort of latching onto different elements, as often happens in legal battles like this.
But then it does say, revenue from the other sources and territories has been similarly modest. So they're saying, you've not been paid very much because this film has not made very much.
So it was one of those classic bits of legal filing that began off by saying, we really respect these guys, they're great creators.
They always do that, don't they? Oh, they're such great guys.
We love their work. And then they basically, but I mean in really quite forthright language, tear apart all of the allegations that have been made by Harry Shearer.
And they do that because Vivendi is trying to get this lawsuit dismissed.
Yes, thrown out of court, both the... it's more about the movie and Studio Canal than it is the soundtrack side, although... through various mergers and acquisitions, the soundtrack is within the same company. And the moving of money between Studio Canal and Universal is part of
it. And there
the
is
case.
The accusation in the original lawsuit that there's collusion amongst different divisions of Vivendi to make sure that the money due to the creators doesn't get through.
So they want the case thrown out of court, except for the reversion right bit at the end of the case, which they're quite happy for the judge to consider, providing his conclusion is you don't have a reversion right.
Yes.
So more of the technicalities around the reversion right that we've talked about before.
Basically, Vivendi is fairly confident that it will win every bit of this case, but we'll see.
Yes. Of course, from Harry Shearer's perspective, very high profile case, there is a website for this legal battle.
I love a legal battle with a website.
It's very rare for there to be a website dedicated to a legal battle. And I thought Harry Shearer is concerned. I mean, what he's been saying in the interviews he's given is obviously they want to go and get what they think they deserve from their share of this great movie and phenomenon that they created. But also they feel that there are greater principles involved here. Also, I mean, referring back to some of the transparency stuff we talked about earlier and the behaviour of the big entertainment giants. And so they see it very much as a battle to try and blow open the way that big entertainment companies work with their artists. But Vivendi being very bullish in saying, you don't have a case, let's throw it out of court before we can even start. The Harry Shearer and the other guys from Spinal Tap yet to respond to Vivendi's papers. Guess we'll find out what they have to say about it.
We'll keep an eye on their website.
We'll keep an eye on the website for updates.
That's it for this week's CMU podcast. You'll notice we didn't answer a listener question this week.
There was too much to talk about because we've been away for 3 weeks.
But if you have a question about anything music industry
related, providing the question isn't where is the highlights of output podcast.
Yeah, don't
we've already answered that, yeah. Surely. But it is coming soon. Look out for it on the website.
But anything you've ever wondered about, yeah, we'll see if we can find out. Just email us, cmupodcast@unlimitedmedia.co.uk, and we'll get back to you on a future edition of the podcast. The CMU podcast is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, you can go to CompleteMusicUpdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.